Our next case is 12-1834, the State of Ohio versus Christopher Anderson. Mr. Rivera.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. Today we are here to answer one question. The question is whether a trial court's denial of a pretrial motion to dismiss based on both double jeopardy and due process following a hung jury is a final appealable order pursuant to revised code 2505.02. This case comes following an en banc decision from the 7th District. Sitting en banc, the 7th District concluded that such an order was a final appealable order in light of the amendments to revised code 2505.02. This case presents a rare and unique set of circumstances as the defendant's motion to dismiss followed the fifth trial or attempt at a conviction of Mr. Anderson. The 7th District's decision to find that such an order is a final appealable order has led to a complete unworkable rule of law going forward as in light of the amendments to the statute. We would ask this court to reaffirm its previous decision in Crego and its stance in Wenzel and find that such orders are not final appealable orders. In highlighting the unworkable rule of law that this decision has resulted in, we could look first to the 7th District's opinion. The 7th District clearly stated that their decision was limited to the very specific facts and unique facts of this case. The court even went on to conclude that had the facts been different, that it would have found that trial court's denial was not a final appealable order pursuant to Crego and pursuant to its own decision in State versus Hubbard, which the 7th District decision in Hubbard came in 1999, which followed the amendments to revised code 2505.02. Therefore, the 7th District stated that had the defendant only filed his motion following one mistrial, that it would have found that the denial was not final and appealable.
Counsel, we had the scenario here. There was a mistrial at the request of the state, correct? And then a reversal on appeal, and two hung juries, and a mistrial because of a defense attorney, correct?
That is correct. I believe the first mistrial was, the very first mistrial was, I believe, at defense request because it was the first one, the state's witness had mentioned a prior incident which the court had ruled was inadmissible, and then it was repeated on the evening news later that night. So I'm positive that was requested at defense by defense counsel.
So this is the sixth potential trial we're talking about here?
Yes, absolutely.
And we're talking double jeopardy then?
Defense counsel raised both double jeopardy and a due process argument. However, this particular denial came following a hung jury. So we are narrowed in this case to talking about a final appealable order in regards to a motion to dismiss following a hung jury, not necessarily a mistrial that resulted in as the error of the witness or defense counsel apparently falling asleep, and not this defense counsel. Clearly, the statute has been amended since this court's opinion in Crego and Wenzel. The biggest change was subsection B4. B4 talks, and the legislature in enacting or amending the statute included subsection B4, which includes a provisional remedy. The 7th District found that the defendant's motion to dismiss fell into or qualified as a provisional remedy. And looking to their decision, there was there's absolutely no analysis as to why it qualified as a provisional remedy. They simply concluded that it was. However, starting with this this court's definition of a provisional remedy and applying the definition of ancillary to a motion to dismiss, a motion to dismiss in no circumstances can qualify as a provisional remedy. The fact being is that an ancillary proceeding is one that aids another proceeding. A motion to dismiss in no way aids another proceeding, for example, the criminal proceeding or the criminal trial. To find that a motion to dismiss is ancillary would basically find that nearly any type of order or motion in a criminal trial or that precedes a criminal trial would also be ancillary, which would defeat the legislative intent. If their intent was to include these type of orders or all orders that affect or that involve a criminal proceeding, they would have put it into the statute. The defendant clearly wants a broad wants the definition of ancillary to be as broad as possible to encompass these types of motions.
Counsel, let me ask you a question, because I've got the Court of Appeals decision in front of me, and they're quoting the United States Supreme Court that says it's clear the double jeopardy clause is a guarantee against being twice put to trial for the same offense. I'm sure everybody in this room agrees with that.
Right. No, we would.
How? Well, you will agree with that, the United States Supreme Court.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. But my question to you is, how do you affect that right if you're not allowed to appeal it before the sixth, or as Justice Lansker said, the sixth trial? How do you affect that right if you're precluded from appealing when the trial court says, okay, everybody, suit them up, we're going to do it again?
We believe that the proper remedy is following a direct appeal. And I think the danger...
You mean following the trial?
Correct. And I think the danger, in when I spoke earlier about an unworkable rule, is because we have such a unique set of circumstances, and if this court would hold that it is a final appealable order, when you're talking about a motion to dismiss, it would have to include any type of motion to dismiss, whether it's based on a speedy trial, a number of different types of motions would have to fall into this category, or would have to fall into the definition of a provisional remedy. The heart of the double jeopardy clause is to not be twice put in jeopardy. That goes to an acquittal, and we're not talking about an acquittal in this case. We're talking about again a rare set of circumstances.
What was the basis for the denial, or excuse me, the basis for the motion, violation of the defendant's rights in double jeopardy? Based on what? Too many trials?
Essentially. I think that the too many trials, that was focused on the due process argument, but I think there was, if you look through the motion, it's in the record, that was the theme of too many trials is I believe encompassed by both arguments, and that is the main.
Didn't the United States Supreme Court say in Abney that it is a denial, or it is a the double jeopardy clause guarantees against being twice put in jeopardy at trial?
Right, and I believe that goes towards the issue of an acquittal, and that circumstance.
So
is,
the fact that he's been tried five times already doesn't affect your argument, you're saying?
No, because it would lead to virtually any type of order being final and appealable if this court would find that this type of a denial is a final appealable order in this circumstance. It's well established that the double jeopardy clause does not preclude a trial following a mistrial, especially in light of the mistrial was caused or preceded by a hung jury, and that is the case that we have here. I mean, that has been well established throughout.
You will agree, however, that jeopardy attaches when evidence begins, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So that jeopardy attached in the first trial, the second trial, third, on through the fifth.
Right.
My question is, it just seems to me you're asking this court to authorize the state of Ohio to say, trust us, we won't do this unnecessarily, and it can be cleaned up in the appellate process. But the reality is, you can't give this person that time back, can you?
No. I mean, in that sense, you can't give him the time back. But again, that's assuming that his arguments are meritorious at the end. I mean, that's making that assumption. The jeopardy may attach, but jeopardy does not bar the subsequent trial.
I agree with you on that, but you must also agree that it's not up to the state of Ohio to make that determination.
No, absolutely not. I think the determination is looking towards, specifically in this case, looking at the revised code. And a motion to dismiss, it just does not meet the definition of a provisional remedy. If the legislature intended to include such orders as final appealable order, they would have to include it in the statute. This Crago and Wenzel have been, obviously they were decided some years ago, and the legislature has made no attempt to amend the statute since.
Although in State versus Thomas, we had originally stated this was a special proceeding because of the double jeopardy implications, that the review of a motion to dismiss, or the review of the situation should be allowed under a special proceeding in State versus Thomas. Crago was a very short opinion that just overruled Thomas without much analysis at all.
I agree with your statement. However, the changes since then, obviously Crago rejected Thomas and those conclusions, and also after Crago, now a special proceeding has now been defined by the legislature, and in the state's position, the legislature's newly enacted definition of a special proceeding would again, a motion to dismiss for the various reasons would still not qualify as a special proceeding. Again, to conclude that a motion to dismiss, whether it's based on double jeopardy or a due process argument, would leave with a very broad meaning of this word, which would encompass just about every order or every denial that occurs in the process of a criminal trial or getting to that trial itself. If I could, I would like to reserve the remaining time for rebuttal.
Fine, thank you. Mr. Juhas.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm John Juhas. I represent the appellee in this case, Christopher Anderson. Chris Anderson was arrested on August 22nd of 2002. As of August 22nd of this year, he has been in jail or in prison for 11 years. As of today, 4,065 days, with, as you have suggested in your questions of Mr. Rivera, there have been three full trials, one that was reversed on appeal, two that resulted in hung juries. There have been a total of four mistrials. That means, in terms of the double jeopardy language, that five times already Christopher Anderson has suffered the anxiety, the expense, the personal strain of risking a conviction for an offense for which he says he's innocent.
But these trials were legitimately declared not to be trials because of the nature of the outcome. A hung jury, a reversal by the Court of Appeals with a remand for a retrial. These were all trials that were legitimately disposed of and were not, none of the trials was there an acquittal.
That's correct. And I assume what you're addressing yourself to is the Perez manifest necessity in each one of the cases. And the basis of the motion to dismiss is It is twofold, as Mr. Rivera said. It argues double jeopardy, but it principally argues due process. And it doesn't suggest that a motion like that can be filed after a first mistrial where there's a manifest necessity. But the lead due process case that was cited there was, in my estimation, a marvelous opinion from a guy from Watergate days vintage, Gerhard Gesell, who wrote an opinion in a D.C. case. In that case, two times the state had gone to trial, or the government had gone to trial, two times there was a hung jury. And Judge Gesell said, and in fact, he said, this isn't a case of double jeopardy in his opinion, it's a case of due process and fair play. The government cannot, consistent with the Constitution, continue to simply rack up the pool balls and see if they can break it in a way to convict the defendant.
And what is the test to determine that? Is, you know, two trials too few, five trials too many? What's the test that we would employ here?
Well, first of all, I don't know that we're there yet because those issues have not been argued and briefed. We're actually here on the limited issue of whether or not he can actually appeal to the Court of Appeals. I can't resist saying it's mildly ironic to me that the Court of Appeals has not yet itself issued a final appeal.
That was my question for you. I'm really confused on what we're here for today, because wouldn't it have been the better practice for the 7th District Court of Appeals to say, this is a final appealable order and we're going to address it, and it was double jeopardy, or is double jeopardy? That didn't happen, did it?
That didn't happen. And actually, in my memorandum opposing jurisdiction, that's what I said to this court, which is that it's ironic that the state is in the 7th District saying, Anderson, you can't do this, it's not a final appealable order. All the 7th District said is, we're not deciding the merits of the case. We're just going to decide that it's a case that we're going to hear. You may have a valid due process argument, you may not. You may have a valid double jeopardy argument, you may not. All we're saying as the 7th District is, your appeal can continue. The state appealed to this court from that ruling, I guess I would call it. And in my memorandum opposing, I said, geez, it seems kind of ironic to me that this court would take the case because there is no final decision.
So if we do decide to affirm the Court of Appeals here, it goes back to the Court of Appeals and you'll be back here before us?
Presumably. That's correct. That is correct. And so actually, unfortunately, this time is just continue to accrue. But as inconvenient as that is for a guy who is today spending his 4,065th day in jail, we have to abide by the law. And if there's not a final decision from the Court of Appeals, then I think it needs to go back there for that decision. It's the reason that, honestly, I don't know that I can answer your earlier question about what's the standard, except to say that it's something more than one and something less than 10 years in prison and a sixth attempt to rack it up. Because, as I believe it was Justice O'Neill said, I don't know that this can or should be entrusted to the state to say, we're going to decide when we've had enough. Because in this case, obviously, the state has said, we haven't had enough yet. And the thrust of those double jeopardy cases and the thrust of those due process cases that were cited in the trial court is, there comes a point in time where a judge has to step in and say stop.
But that's now, also going to depend on a court looking at the quality of the evidence and the reasons for the prior hungs, juries, or reversals and remands.
Yes. I am not standing here arguing that we can make a rule here that will apply to all situations, nor do I think that we should.
Why not?
Because I think every case is going to have to turn on its own situation.
But this case that's before us, the question is, a denial of a motion to dismiss on double jeopardy is a final appealable order.
On that, you can make a definitive decision.
Okay.
Yeah, I was trying to answer Chief Justice O'Connor's question about how many, litmus test for when there's a due process violation or when there's not. As to the question before us, you can absolutely give a definitive answer that it is a final appealable order. Why? First of all, I think if you look to the statute itself, I'd have to respectfully disagree with Mr. Rivera's interpretation of the statute. Certainly, I think that what's involved here is a substantial right. And I think if you go back and look at Abney and some of the cases, I believe in Abney there's a quote even I believe from Justice Jackson in an earlier case, and what he essentially says is you have to look at the nature of the violation. If it's something that can't be adequately addressed by waiting for an appeal, then it's appropriate to appeal now. Now, of course, the state says, well, ABNY doesn't apply because it was interpreting a federal statute. True, but that doesn't mean the reasoning doesn't apply. And the harm here, you know, Mr. Rivera suggests, well, the time to decide all this is if when there's another trial and then there be an appeal, and then Mr. Anderson can have his double jeopardy and his due process argument heard. We say no. Why do we say no? Because even if there's an acquittal in trial number 6, if Mr. Anderson's argument about double jeopardy and due process is correct, there's been a violation, even if there's an acquittal, because racking them up in the box for the sixth time is, at the very latest, the violation. I would argue that the violation occurs when he goes through the expense and anxiety of once again preparing.
But so haven't we said in Crago that the denial of a motion to dismiss on double jeopardy grounds is not a final appeal?
You did say that. And,
right?
And
why do you feel that you're not bound by that? Because of the number of hung juries?
No, I don't feel...
What is the basis that you say that Crago does not apply if it is, in fact, the law for all other jurisdictions?
I'm not sure that it's the law for all other jurisdictions, to be honest with you.
Usually what we say binds every
judge. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant other states. Forgive me.
Well,
you mean,
we have 12 districts in Ohio.
So you mean the districts within Ohio. Forgive me. Yes. However, two things. One is that the statute has been amended since Crago was decided.
Okay.
Two, I would have to agree with Justice Lanziger, and I might even go a step further when she says there's not much analysis. I don't really think there's any analysis in Crago. It just seems to be somebody looks at the statute and goes, oh, this doesn't fit, and Thomas is overruled.
Well, and Thomas was a unanimous opinion, and Crago was 4-3 as well, with two paragraphs,
yes,
basically.
Yes. So not strong analysis, but even if you don't accept that argument, I think if you look at the statute, and I quoted, I believe in my brief, some of the legislative history, if you look at that, I think there's an intent here to make these things appealable.
So you want us, if we agree with your position, we would overrule Crago or modify it?
I don't think you
what
need,
would we do with it?
I think you can sort of leave it sitting in the closet, Justice O'Donnell, because Crago is a case that interprets a statute that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. So I think you can simply take the new statute and say, here's what that statute means. Not as Mr. Rivera suggests for every motion to dismiss that every defendant files on every subject, but for a motion to dismiss that implicates a constitutional right, the remedy for which has to happen, if there's going to be a remedy, has to happen before the trial. That's the nature of the right involved here. I would point out, by the way, that Mr. Rivera has suggested that, well, if the legislature meant for this type of a motion to be in the statute, the legislature would have said so. When they do define provisional remedy, they do use those words including but not limited to, and my recollection is that Judge D'Onofrio highlighted those words in his opinion for the court down below. Judge DeGennaro suggested in her concurring opinion that the way that the matters are being handled now is actually unconstitutional. That's pretty strong language. I'm not sure I completely disagree with it, because I think her point is what the federal courts have recognized, which is that the very nature of the right is one that, if the trial takes place, the right has been extinguished. I think this court has recognized that in some other cases, some of the forced medication cases where defendants have been found incompetent. You've obviously said that there's no effective remedy for the defendant to challenge that if you forcibly medicate them, make them competent, convict them, and then appeal. And then the Chambliss case that Mr. Hardwick cited in his amicus brief talks about the choice of counsel. Those are the types of things that it doesn't open a floodgate of anything. If you look at what's happened since ABNY, we don't hear about a floodgate being opened in the federal courts of people making these challenges. It's not going to open the floodgates. It's simply going to recognize, as this statute was intended to, that if you have a substantial right, it is a final order that you can challenge prior to the time that you go to trial. Unless there are no other questions, I have nothing else.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel, you've reserved a little over 2 minutes.
Thank you. I want to pick up where I left off with talking about provisional remedies. If we look at the prior cases from this court, in Muncy and Upshaw are two examples where this court goes through a thorough analysis of this statute. And again,
the new statute or the previous?
The new statute. Upshaw was decided in 2006, okay. And so was Muncy was also decided after the amendment. Both Muncy and Upshaw were both similar cases, as Muncy concluded that a order for forced medication was a provisional remedy. Upshaw, an order finding a criminal defendant incompetent to stand trial was likewise a provisional remedy. These were provisional remedies. What this court said simply, you can't go back once this is done. You can't take the medicine from a defendant. You cannot take the treatment that's done. Here, what can be undone, and what even the 7th District previously said can be undone, if the denial was an error, if the trial court erred in denying the motion to dismiss, that can be fixed. The 7th District said this. And that is why that's why the motion to dismiss in this case does not fit the definition of a provisional remedy. And I'm not saying that the state should be able to try Mr. Anderson as many times until we get that conviction or the ultimate conviction or an acquittal. The legislature says this. The legislature says this order is not a final appealable order. And it's through the language in the statute that allows the state this unique set of circumstances in essentially continuing to try the defendant.
So if you could clarify procedurally, we're here on a denial of a motion to dismiss, right? It was the state's motion to dismiss that was ultimately denied by the Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
Using your reasoning, do we have jurisdiction to review the denial of a motion to dismiss?
I believe this court does. Simply, the decision of the 7th District was that it was a final, that the trial court's denial was a final appealable order. That decision conflicted with their decision in Hubbard, which took place or was decided after the amendments. That was a conflict. The appellate rules allow two decisions, which the state advocates that those were decisions that are in conflict, that allows the court to sit en banc. The court did that, and then concluded with a split decision, 2-2, and ultimately that it was final appealable order. This court's rules then allow a discretionary appeal from an en banc decision, and it's through that rationale that the issue is properly before this case, or before this court.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision.